Into the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Friday, August 2nd, 2013. This is podcast number 336, and my name is Ben Stone. A couple quick announcements. Well, maybe a little more than quick. I really want to say something. I think it's pretty important today as one of the announcements. We do have our Bad Quaker t-shirts with the new logo on those, and stickers as well. And you can get to those by going to badquaker.com, look across the pictures right there at the top of the page, look over to the right-hand side underneath the pictures, and there's a link there to buy stuff, and go to that link, and in there you'll see it says click here to buy shirts and stickers. So just click that. It'll take you over to Kelly's website at Survival Gear Bags. And Kelly is taking care of all the marketing in for us so that we don't have to hassle with all that stuff. And you'll find the stuff that you want right there. And just get yourself one of these really cool new Bad Quaker t-shirts with a new logo on it. And to the listener who designed that logo, I thank you again very much. It's really a cool logo. And we really like it. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention is that we're kicking back and forth this idea of a low bandwidth and a high bandwidth, and we're not really sure where we're going to go with that. We're still taking input, and we do appreciate the different notes that people have sent us and left on the website and email and everything. So we're still working on what our final decision on that's going to be. And I want to mention again, you'll probably hear the commercial in today's podcast for the secure telephones, and I'm really liking this secure telephone. It's really cool, military-grade encryption. It cannot be listened to by anyone except for the person who I want to hear it, and it's really cool. And plus, it's a really good MP3 player. Now, there's another thing that's going to be coming up here pretty soon, and I'm really excited about it. Michael Dean over at the Freedom Fiends heard a thing that Mark Edge over at Free Talk Live said. And Mark Edge said that he would give, he had a $5 Walmart gift certificate, and he would be willing to give that. You know how they have these buyback programs where police or other agencies will buy guns for like a set amount for like $100 or $50 or whatever. And they'll usually give you they won't actually give you money. They'll give you like a coupon or a gift certificate to Walmart or whatever. And you turn in a gun, they have no questions asked, and they'll give you like $100 gift certificate. Well, so Mark Edge, evidently, and I didn't hear this when it happened. Evidently, he said this a while back, but he said that he would give a $5 Walmart gift certificate to anyone that would turn in one of these Bearcats, you know, the armed personnel carriers that generally people are referring to them as a tank, but it's an armed personnel carrier that police forces are now scooping up with free government money coming in from the Department of Homeland Security or whoever. Anyway, so Mark Edge says, you know what, let's get these violent weapons of war off the streets. Mark says, you know, if you just bring me a Bearcat, no questions asked, I'll give you a $5 gift certificate for Walmart. So Michael Dean caught this and thought it was pretty funny and really wants to get behind it. So in the coming weeks, you may see some advertising or you may hear some things about it or whatever. But I thought it was worth mentioning because I think it's just a really funny thing. And I think it's worthwhile to make a big deal out of it and really throw this back in their face. Weapons of war, yeah, because that's what it actually is. I mean, an armed personnel carrier is a weapons of war, and they're being put on American streets by criminals, by thugs that cannot be held responsible for their actions. So, yeah. Now, one other thing that I wanted to mention today And I'm saying this rather than running a commercial at halfway through the podcast like I normally do. I want to talk about Amagi Metals because I just the other day, you know, I've been watching the price on spot silver and spot gold. And I don't have a lot of extra money. I don't have very much extra money at all, actually. But I know that, you know, the dollar is going to start devaluating again. I know that the Fed is going to continue its shenanigans. I know these things are going to happen. And so I have, you know, a deep desire to prepare ahead for what I know is coming at us. And I've been watching the price of precious metals. And it's increasingly difficult to actually get your hands on physical, you know, precious metals. Locally, coin shops don't want to let go of their supply. More and more online sources are either closing down or there's long delays or whatever. So I was watching the price, I guess, about a week ago, and I saw the, you know, a moment of opportunity. I jumped on the internet. I got over to Amagi Metals, and made a purchase right away. And I thought, boy, you know that, with the delay that so many people online are given in shipping, I was hoping, you know, my wife and I are going to be leaving for this a thing in Michigan, the Midwest Peace and Liberty Rally or whatever it's called. I don't have my note in front of me. Oh, here it is. Yeah, I do. The first annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest hosted by the Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition. Anyway, so we're going to be headed to that in a couple weeks. And right after I got done making the order for the metal at Amagi Metals, I thought, oh man, I hope they can get that in, you know, before we have to leave, because I don't want the, you know, the post office just delivering a quantity of valuable metal and just leaving it in my mailbox for a week. So I was kind of thinking about that. I'm thinking, well, maybe I can get one of my kids to come over and check the mail every day, and you know, maybe I can figure out something. But Amagi Metals went one step further. They processed that order and got it to me within just a couple days. As a matter of fact, I had ordered some sewage treatment chemicals from Amazon, and almost exactly the same time as I ordered the metals from Amagi Metals, and the sewer treatment chemicals from Amazon didn't get here as quick as the precious metals did from Amagi Metals. So this is my little commercial for today. I won't play the other commercial. I'll save you having to sit through a commercial twice. But this is my commercial for today for Amagi Metals. Get over to badquaker.com, scroll down the right-hand side of the page, and you'll see the button there for Amagi Metals. Right now is the time to buy precious metals. And I'm seeing from the feedback from Amagi Metals that we are getting a lot of people are going through the Bad Quaker website to get to them, and I really appreciate that. I really appreciate every purchase that you guys are doing that because it helps keep this podcast on the air. But also, for our own benefits, for your own benefit, for your family's benefit, now is the time to purchase precious metals because the price has dipped, and it, you know, all the experts say it's not going to stay like that long. As soon as they start money pumping again, the, you know, the price of metals is going to go back up, and you know, we're looking at very much the same kind of a bubble in the economy that we saw in 2006 and 2007. So if you recall what happened then, you can pretty much expect that to be happening within the next 6 months to a year. And I'm I have to give all the legal advice. I'm not giving advice, but you know, listen to what I'm saying anyway, because whatever I'm saying is not really advice, but take my advice. All that silly nonsense that people say to keep themselves, you know, legally covered or whatever. But I'm just looking at this situation for me, for my benefit, and I'm saying this dip is a good opportunity. This dip in the prices is a good opportunity to just shove a little bit of spare cash in there, even if it's only, you know, one round of silver or you know, a small quantity of gold or whatever you can afford, to get it now while the price is down. Because I'll tell you, when things turn bad is the wrong time to start planning for disaster. When things are still good, that's when you need to plan for disaster. All right, so that's my commercial from Amagi Metals, and I appreciate those guys being our sponsor and sticking with us too. Now, I've got some kind of disturbing things I wanted to talk about today. I was going to sort of play around with the title a little bit and call it something like State of the Union or something like that, and play around with maybe make some kind of a pun with that. But I haven't quite figured that out. Maybe I'll do that in post-production and get a cutesy name for this podcast today. But before I get into the negative aspects of the podcast, I have something a little lighter, a little bit of humor to inject into this. And maybe it won't be humor for a lot of people, but for some of the old-time listeners that have been with me since the beginning, and some of my old-time friends on the internet that that know me from days gone by, back when I was well, let's just go on from there, shall we? Okay, so we've got this guy on the internet named Jack Spearco, who has his own podcast, and I got a notice from different people telling me that Jack on his podcast had announced that he's now an anarchist. He had called himself an anarchist on his podcast. And of course, I giggled when I heard that, and then several other people let me know, and I got a good little bit of a humor out of it. Then I decided to go over and actually listen to his podcast and see what he had to say about it, which in the same podcast where he calls himself an anarchist, he also spouts the old Republican Party line blather about America being a constitutional republic and how it's our duty to uphold the Constitution. Also in that very same podcast where he declared himself an anarchist, he also sets up several straw men as he explains what an anarchist is and is not. And, he doesn't really go into what it is not. He just makes accusations of what some anarchists are, but he's not like that. He's a different kind that he's making up in his own mind. And then he's talking about whether or not you're a slave, and it's very convoluted, his whole description there. But that shouldn't really strike anybody as odd when you hear his sort of weird description of himself as an anarchist. I remember back in 2008 when he very first started calling himself a libertarian. And at the time, on his podcast, he was offering the solution to the drug problem in America as being that a team of cops should park down the street from every drug house and just arrest everybody going into and out of every drug house until they, send the message that we're not going to tolerate this anymore. That was his libertarian view of the drug war in 2008. And, and he's come a long way since then. He's changed his opinion on a lot of different things. But even as lately as a year ago, he was trying to explain what a libertarian was. And in his podcast, he did a whole podcast just trying to explain what a libertarian was. And it was so backwards and convoluted that the definition really, he almost got nothing right in what he was saying.
Yes.
Okay, we had a slight delay there. I had to step away and take a phone call from a city zoning inspector. I'll talk about that in a minute. But that guy, anyway. So back to old Jack. Jack Spearco, unless he's changed this in the last very short period of time, Jack Spearco is a greenbacker. He's, he believes, or at least he has in the past. I haven't followed his changes. Maybe he's changed this position as well. But he even went so far as to write a book about greenbacker policy and what, how we need to adopt the greenbacker policy and so forth. And, greenbacker, as I pointed out before, and I went through pretty methodically, I think, and shown that being a greenbacker, you have to be a socialist. You have to adopt a socialist position to adopt the greenbacker position. And, that's just, it's like you can't be in the middle of the ocean 10 feet down and dry. There's just a contradiction here. One leads to the other. It's not like, and let me explain really quick. To be a greenbacker, this is the idea that Congress should have complete control of the money supply. Congress should work with the Treasury Department and print money as needed. just fiat money, just created as needed. And the greenbackers, they have some nuances. They, you know, they want to get rid of a credit. They want to not have interest rates. They, some of them talk about a year of jubilee, they call it. And there's all kinds of stuff that goes with all this nonsense. But one way or the other, it can only be done through socialist mechanisms. And when you have the government centrally planning the primary means of production, which is the money supply, then you have socialism. That's what socialism is. And that's what the greenbackers want. They want Congress to directly, centrally plan the money supply, the primary means of production for the United States. So that's socialism. And so Jack, unless he's changed things, Jack has been a greenbacker and a socialist for years, yet he called himself a libertarian. Now, evidently, he's calling himself an anarchist. Jack went so far, I've mentioned this, I think, to write a book explaining his greenbacker theories. And he, at the time, he asked me to kind of read through it and, you know, go through the content and kind of work with him. And he said that he would give me credits in the book if I would do that with him. So I went through and I read it, and I basically told him, you know, the truth. I said, Jack, this is greenbacker stuff. What you're proposing here is identical to the Mississippi scheme that John Law used to destroy the French economy. I mean, if you just look at it, that's what it is. I shouldn't be shocked then that he didn't give me credit on his on the book. He never gave me credit on it, but that's okay, because I told him, you know, writing my name on the book one way or the other, I don't have any. It's your book. You write on it or don't write on it. It's not my, you know. He asked if he could have permission to put my name on there as a contributor to it, and I said, I don't. That's IP rights. I don't have any rights to whether or not you put my name on the book. So you do it if you feel like it, and don't do it if you don't. So I think that's probably why he didn't, was because I told him that it was greenbacker nonsense and that he was a socialist. So now he says he's an anarchist. But, you know, and to give Jack credit, because Jack is really brilliant when it comes to marketing. And so, you know, he understands demographics. He understands changes in a market. He's really good at that kind of thing. So I have to wonder if maybe Jack's demographics indicated that his listeners were increasingly more and more becoming anarchist in their thinking. And if Jack is just responding to that, because he really understands how marketing works. So again, I have to wonder, you know, if Jack's demographics showed that his listeners were increasingly into cosplay, I wonder if Jack would suddenly announce that he really likes anime and J-pop and J-rock. Or maybe if Jack's demographics indicated that his listeners were into steampunk, I wonder if Jack would announce that he was totally into pocket watches. You know, I can't help but just to wonder that kind of thing. So that's the twisted way my mind thinks. And when I hear that, I literally giggled when I heard that he had called himself an anarchist, because he said such hateful things to people over the years, and specifically to me, at a time when I thought we were friends. I thought that he and I were pretty good friends. We've spent a lot of time together, you know, sat around a campfire. And I really thought we were pretty good friends, and he really spewed some hate at me over that issue of anarchism. So I kind of got a kick out of that, you know. But I look at it this way. I think Jack Spierko is an anarchist like Rand Paul or Jack Hunter are libertarians. So, yeah, that's how much faith I have in that. But now for something completely different, okay? So it probably sounds like I was picking on the poor guy. Maybe a little bit. Maybe a little, but it's humor. It's fun. It's funny, and it's fun. So now on to something that's a little bit more serious. You know, this Snowden thing with Edward Snowden, one of the early questions, I haven't really talked about it a lot on the podcast at all, but I haven't talked about the Bradley Manning thing very much either. But then I had Chandler on the other day, and we kind of kicked around a little bit about it, and I thought, you know, I need to clarify a little bit on the topic. I need to just at least touch on it, because it is it's not just a current event. This is pivotal moments in history happen, And years later, people come back and look at it and say, I wonder what people thought about that when it happened. Well, I don't want to let this opportunity pass without saying something about it. So when the Snowden story first broke, there were some people questioned whether it was legitimate, whether it was, or whether it was a red herring, whether it was something that was thrown out just to distract people, because there had been so many of us on the internet that had been saying everything that Edward Snowden said. We've been saying it for years. We've been saying this stuff. And, you know, the conspiracy, the other people are calling us, well, you're just a conspiracy nut or whatever. And they're throwing this language out at us like we're kooks because we talk about, with the government spying on people and how in-depth the spying is taking place and who they're spying on. And we say this kind of stuff. And we've taken a lot of heat. Those of us who've talked about this have taken a lot of heat over the years for this. Going back into the mid-2000s, when this stuff really started coming out as to what all they were doing. Well, now, so Edward Snowden comes out and says this. So then early on, when this first happened, there were these questions. Well, is he legitimate? Is he legitimate? Is this a red herring just to throw people off the scent? Is this, and then, I think he made some critical mistakes. Bradley Manning made some critical mistakes. And I thought, if I'm going to say something about this, what I need to say is not what happened already. I need to say something for people who might be in a position like Manning or Snowden, and like they were in before they revealed the stuff that they revealed, and maybe give some insight as to what Snowden and Manning did that was really, really, really not wise, and maybe give a different path that people in the future can maybe think about. If you work in a government installation like that, or you work in a position where you can get your hands on that kind of material, man, don't do what Snowden and Manning did. And I'm not saying don't leak. I'm saying don't do it the way they did it. Look at these two guys. Manning is probably going to be in prison for the rest of his life. He's been essentially tortured now for how long? A couple of years that they've been torturing him. And, so what about it? Snowden? Snowden's going to have to basically live on the lam the rest of his life. If the CIA ever gets the opportunity, they're going to pop him. I mean, they're just going to do it, he can never travel freely, no matter where he's at. And so he's in Russia. And so now Russia said, oh, well, we're going to give him immunity. We're going to let him stay here. Well, what's that mean? You're in one of the most corrupt countries in the world. You're no more safe there than you are in Detroit. In many ways, you're safer in Detroit, especially, if you're not walking around with a sign saying who you are. So there are ways to do these things. Let's say you work for the government, and let's say you're in a position, or let's say you work for some security agency, some corporation or something that is into, this kind of spying or whatever. You're a contractor or whatever, and you see some bit of information that you really think ought to be out to the public. Well, what's your responsibility? What do you need to do? What should you do? What's wise to do? You have to balance these things out. Manning and Snowden are both young guys, and both of them now, their lives are basically shot over this. But they could have done just as much good without risking themselves. They could have done it in a different way and been a lot more safe about it. So, but before I get into that, what's your ethical responsibility when you realize that your job is unethical? What is your responsibility? And this should come, this struck me when I was in the aerospace industry over and over. And I would deal with it different ways at different times. And sometimes I would just plug my ears and close my eyes and keep going. And other times I would speak out about it to my fellow employees. And I went through a lot of different struggles with myself as to what do I do about this? And I tell myself, well, I work... Because I intentionally moved away from the defense end of the business and pushed myself more into commercial airline engines and so forth. And even the work I did with NASA, I justified it because it was work on the high speed civil transport. So I'm telling myself, well, this is I'm not making a weapons of war. This is not destruction that I'm doing here. This is, you know, for the purpose of making transportation better. And I would justify what I was doing like that. But all the time I'm thinking in my mind, you know, I'm feeding this machine. I'm feeding this monster. It's not directly. I'm not directly pointing a gun at anybody's head. I'm not directly flying a drone into a village. I'm not directly doing these things. But I'm putting part of myself into this greater overall thing. And, you know, I had to deal with it day after day, trying to figure out what I was going to do and how I could handle it and what I should do and what my responsibilities were. And really what it comes down to is it's not just ethical responsibilities. It has to be wisdom. Wisdom is the ability to judge what's right and wrong while balancing your actions based on what will produce the best results in the long run. Think about what Bastiat said about the good economist. The good economist doesn't just look at the immediate effect. The good economist steps back and says, what's going to be the ripple? What's going to happen in the long run? What's going to happen long term when this thing works its way out? And so before the younger, and I'm not saying this to insult anybody who's young, but it, for me at least, the younger that I was, the less wisdom that I had. And the older that I get, the more wisdom that I have, because wisdom is something that you gain slowly through experience. You know, understanding ethics and understanding right and wrong is almost intuitive to humans, or maybe it is intuitive. Some might argue that it is intuitive. I would argue that to a large extent it's intuitive in humans. We even babies understand to a certain extent what's right and what's wrong. So knowing that when you're 15 or 20 or 25 is not that difficult. It's not difficult to say, you know what, I'm supporting aggression. This is wrong. And so you get a young guy like Manning or like Snowden, and it's not that hard for them to recognize evil when they see it. Even though, you know, we've got 12 or 14 or 18 years of brainwashing through government schools and through universities and so forth and through the military indoctrination, it's still not that hard to look at what you're doing and say, this is wrong, this is evil, I can't of a good conscience continue doing this. But then with age, wisdom starts to set in and says, okay, then, if you're not going to do this anymore, if you can't do this evil thing anymore for a living, if that's the point that you've come to, then let's devise an exit strategy that is going to produce the best in the long run for this. Let's not just say, that's it, I'm quitting, I walk out. Let's not just open up the floodgates and dump information on the internet without really knowing what the consequences are going to be. Instead, let's weigh through our options and let's figure out a way that we can secure ourselves, get ourselves, our own physical body, into a safe position before the enemy realizes what we've done to him. And there's all kinds of ways you can do that. Snowden almost pulled it off. He went to Hong Kong before he actually did the interview with Greenwald and revealed everything. Now, that was much more wise than what Manning did. Manning contacted WikiLeaks while he's still sitting right in there in the mouth of the beast. Well, then he's shocked when he gets arrested. Or, you know, I don't know if he was actually shocked or not, but, you know, maybe he was so naive he thought that they would not do the things they did to him. I don't know. I don't know what was going through his mind. But one way or the other, you know, allowing yourself to go through the torture that he went through was not wise. It's not necessary. Martyrdom is not necessary, and it doesn't help anything. You know, some people are a little bit awakened by watching what Manning went through during this time frame, seeing these things. But from more of an individual's point of view, you know, we don't need to sacrifice ourselves like that. I talk all the time about that, you know, martyrdom never accomplishes what the martyr thinks it's going to accomplish. So, you know, I really advise against that. And I don't know if that was Manning's point or not, or if he was just naive and thought that it wouldn't go the way that it went. So now let's jump back to Snowden. So he goes to Hong Kong, which is a good start. And he contacts Glenn Greenwald, which is a good start. But what he maybe should have thought about doing was getting someplace, not Hong Kong, someplace far more remote and secure. I'm thinking of places in South America that are, you know, less likely to extradite him back to the U.S. Hong Kong is not that big of a place, and it's a very easy place. You know, if it would be different if he were native to that area and he could blend in, that would be different, but he's not. I would think, oddly enough, I would think he'd be safer in Australia or Canada than he would be in Hong Kong or even Russia, where he's at now. You know, it wouldn't be that difficult if you have any outdoor skills whatsoever. It wouldn't be that difficult to live in Canada unseen by the government. Far as that goes, if you have any outdoor skills, it wouldn't be that hard to live, you know, within the borders of the U.S. and vanish from the eyes of the government. But once you go to a foreign country where you're dependent upon, you know, language translation and money issues and all these other things, then you really set yourself up to be found by the, you know, by the CIA or by whoever. And I can just imagine a scenario where they find Snowden in a ditch somewhere in a Russian city, and his wallet is missing or whatever, and he's shot three or four times. And they say, well, see, you know, if he'd just gone back to the U.S., he'd have been fine. But now he's been murdered by thieves who stole his wallet and his watch or whatever. And the whole time the CIA giggles and walks away from the situation, and the problem's solved. You know, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that's how the story of Snowden ends. And I certainly wouldn't feel safe in any Russian city because, you know, the CIA has operated over there for so long in so many different ways. And the country itself, the government is so corrupt. I would be comfortable almost anywhere else rather than there. But, you know, again, let's go back to maybe a wiser way of doing this. So first off, you have to secure where you're going to go, and you have to secure the funding to be able to live when you get there, and you have to secure some way to make a living once your funding starts to run out, because none of us have, you know, maybe there's somebody who has unlimited funding, but nobody I know. So you need to think these things through, and then you need to determine your escape route. When you go, let's say in Snowden's case, you go from the U.S. to Hong Kong, well, okay, that might not be bad as the starting point, and you do your interview with Greenwald, but like the minute the interview is over, you go straight from there to the airport, and you're in a totally different country before Greenwald has the opportunity to push the button. You don't let the situation arrive where the story breaks and you're still in the same location where you were when you did the interview. Yeah, you know, he could have easily been in Chile. He could have been in, pretty much any place. Russia, if that's where he wanted to go, he could have been in Russia before Greenwald broke the story. And that would have been a whole series of steps that would have been invisible, or even if it's not invisible, it would have been a little bit easier to go through those steps and less likely to be detected. You know, but also, here's the thing, and I've talked before about identities. You know, get that identity set up ahead of time. Get yourself an alternative identity that you can jump into, and all of a sudden, you know, you're in the Yucatan somewhere behind a, you know, with a burro and a sack of potatoes or something, and you blend in, and you look like where you're at, and you're no longer Edward Snowden. You know, you think these things through ahead of time. But even better than that is if you can stay in that position, and this is tricky, and this is maybe what Bradley Manning was hoping to do, who knows, but if you can stay in that position and continue to leak stuff, Now, that's the risky part. That's really, really dangerous. And, you know, if you're a person who is married with children, or you've got close relatives, a mother and a father that could really be harmed by your actions, you have to take all that stuff into consideration. But if you can stay in the beast and quietly bring about leaks in other ways while you continue to search for more and more stuff, well, if you can do that and pull it off, then that's great. And like I said, maybe that's what Manning was trying to do. But man, that's a dangerous thing. That's really, you know, you're sitting on the dragon's teeth, tickling his tongue when you're doing that, and then you're just hoping you don't get burned when he hiccups. Okay, I'm going to break here. So if you can stick with me for the break, and I'll be right back.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. And, you know, I said before that I talked about your ethical responsibility once you realize your job is unethical. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this city zoning inspector that I've had to deal with for during this week. We've had a series of situations here at our house. You know, we're not allowed to have our RV. I should have just said motorhome. That way I don't have all these R's getting confused. So we're not allowed, by city ordinance, we're not allowed to have our motorhome parked on our driveway, even though it's our driveway and the motorhome fits on the driveway without interfering with the sidewalk or anything like that. It's still against city ordinance for us to have the motorhome in our own driveway. So I was under the understanding, and I was wrong on this, but I was under the understanding that the city would allow you 72 hours, and this is going by what my neighbors had told me, that the city would allow you to park your motorhome there for 72 hours for loading and unloading. Okay, so I thought, all right, well, fine. So we've had the motorhome now. You know, we've been paying for long-term storage, and when we're not on the road with the motorhome, we keep it in the long-term storage so that it's not parked in our driveway. But when we get ready to leave, or when we're just arriving back home, you know, we have, you pull into town, you've been on the road for a month or whatever, you pull into town, you pull up into the driveway, and you start unloading the motorhome because you have, you know, food in the refrigerator, and you have your clothes, and you have your pillows, and all the stuff that, you know, that you don't leave in the motorhome all the time. And so, you know, so I thought, I was under the impression that, going by what my neighbors had said, that the city would sort of ignore having the motorhome in the driveway for 72 hours so that you could load it or unload it. All right, so you know, so we pulled them, so we had the motorhome out on the road, and we came back, and we were towing a car, our little car behind the motorhome. So when we arrived back from travel with Porkfest and the Pennsylvania Libertarian Party's event that they hosted us at, we got back home from all that, and I couldn't pull the motorhome into the driveway because the car was attached as we in the RV world call it a towed. That's what you call the car that you tow. It's a towed. Anyway, so we had the towed on the back, and so I couldn't pull into the driveway, so I just pulled in front of the house. And as quickly as we could, because we figured, well, they're going to come over here with a ticket as quick as they can, because that's how these rent seekers do. So we pull up in front of the house and jump out. We unload the motorhome as quick as we can. We get the car detached, get the little car trailer off. I pull the car in. We're not even allowed to have a trailer in the driveway. That's how draconian the laws here are. So I pull the trailer up into the garage where you can't see it. And we unload the RV as quickly as we can, and then I get it over to storage. And so, you know, it's set over there a few weeks, but it's been on the road now literally for half of its life since we got the motorhome last year. And this is our second motorhome, so we put a lot of mileage on our first motorhome as well. But since we got the motorhome last year, we've been on the road almost half of its life. So it's, you know, it's time to be serviced. So so we get the motorhome over to the storage, and we got a hold of the RV place where we bought the motorhome, and we arranged for it to be serviced, and we figured out the day and everything. Well, before that's going to take place, we need to drop it off on a Tuesday for the service, so we're going to drive it over here like late Friday night, pull it into the driveway, make sure that everything in it is all ready to go to the dealer. You know, we don't want to leave like a sack of precious metals or a gun or something like this in the RV when it goes to the, you know, to the dealer. So we pull it up in the driveway, and it's there just over the weekend, just long enough to get the stuff out of it. And I had to make an adjustment on one of the things that, that was in there. And then, you know, we get it out of there as soon as the weekend's over. We get it out of there, and we get it to the dealer and get it checked in for them to do some service on it. And Wednesday, just, you know, that fast, we get a threat letter from the city that if we don't remove our RV, that they're going to fine us. And so I'm kind of irritated at this because the RV's been moved. I mean, the RV was literally in the service department of the motorhome place before the city issued the paper that they sent to me, the threat letter that they sent to me. So it was kind of irritating. So I called this clown. City zoning inspector, and I'm just trying to clarify exactly what the rule is so that I don't have to deal with this kind of thing, you know. And he says, "No, you can't put it in your driveway at all. You're not allowed to pull it into your driveway. Period." And I'm like, "Well, how am I supposed to load it or unload it? What you're telling me is the city is forbidding me from going camping because you're forbidding me from loading or unloading my motorhome." And he said, "No, you can park it on the street, and then it wouldn't be within my jurisdiction. That would be a police problem." And I said, "What do you mean a police problem? What does that mean? Are you saying that the police are going to ticket me if I pull it on you know, up against the curb on the street, parallel park it on the street?" "Well, I couldn't say one way or the other," he says. And I'm trying to get just, I mean, the guy is talking state talk. That's what is coming out of his mouth. He's not saying anything definite other than the fact that he's in control of my yard and my driveway is part of my yard, and therefore my driveway and my yard are his jurisdiction, and he's going to ticket me and fine me if I pull the motorhome into my driveway, even for loading and unloading of it. And so I kind of went off on the guy, and I told him about the immorality of his job and how what he does for a living is immoral. He essentially sends threat letters to people. That's his job. His job is to threaten people, and that's immoral. When I pull the motorhome into my driveway and I load or unload the motorhome, I am harming no one, and yet he is threatening me. And so, I gave him my little speech, and that was yesterday. And now today he calls me back and apologized and said, "You know, I guess if you're just loading or unloading, we shouldn't be writing people tickets for that." "Oh, really? You think? Oh, you think? Wow. Somebody bumped into some morals, right?" And he went on to tell, I mean, he was really polite, and he was very apologetic at his attitude from the other day. And, you know, he says, "I couldn't sleep." He says, "Ever since we talked, I couldn't sleep." And I didn't hammer the guy. I was nice to him. And I said, "Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I just want to make sure that we're not going to have a problem if I can pull it in, load it, unload it. And then, you know, I'm not storing it here. We have storage for it." And he understood that. And so we were able to, you know, unofficially come to an agreement that they wouldn't hassle me if I pull it into the driveway for a day or two and load and unload it. But he was genuinely apologizing and so forth. And this got me thinking about that, you know, little seeds that we plant in people's minds to say, "Listen, I know that you're working, and I wasn't this polite with the guy. You know, I hit him pretty hard. But I know you're working to try to support your family. I know that you're doing the best you can. But if you really think about what your job is immoral. The thing that you do is exactly like what the guy who works for the mafia does when he goes and shakes somebody down for cash. What you're doing is threatening peaceable people. You're threatening somebody who's not threatening anybody else. You're threatening somebody who's not harming anybody. And you're doing it for what purpose? Cash. That's the only reason. And if we can get to people, and if we can just, you know, and I failed in a sense because I hit him hard. I mean, I told him, you are an immoral person. You have an immoral job. You are committing acts of immorality. And, you know, I hit him hard with that. But in that particular, and I should have been more polite. I should have been more patient with him. But in that particular case, I think it worked a little bit because, like he said, it cost him nights of sleep. He laid awake at night and realized what he was doing was wrong. And what he was doing was inhumane. And what he was doing was thuggery. And so a person, when they come to this point and they realize, man, you know, my very job description is evil. It's wrong. It's bad. It's immoral. Well, what do you do about that? Well, in his case, you know, his immediate reaction, he called me today and apologized, and we worked out a solution. Well, he's just going to basically look the other way. Well, that's not really a solution. It's still his job to threaten people. He is the city zoning inspector. And it's his job to threaten people. And I should throw this out, too, because this was another point of irritation to us this week. I think it was Monday morning. We woke up to find out that our water heater in our basement had given out and died in a watery death. It finally rusted through in the bottom and started dumping water. Fortunately, there's a drain in the floor right beside the water heater, so the majority of the water was going down that drain, and it didn't do a lot of damage. And we caught it really early, and I shut the water off and got it isolated, figured out what it was going to take to replace it, and we took care of all this stuff. And at first, I was going to just change the water heater out myself. Not that big of a deal. And I was looking at it, and I thought, well, I got to hassle with the gas line that feeds it. I don't really want to deal with a gas line. And the thing is really heavy because it's, you know, this area has hard water. So it has a lot of lime buildup inside the water heater. And I thought, I'm not really in condition to be lifting something like that. My back's in pretty bad shape anyway. So, you know, maybe I'll just have a plumber do it and let a professional handle it. And that way I just, you know, so it cost me a couple hundred extra dollars. I can't really afford that, but I'm going to do it anyway. And that'll save me the hassle of hurting my back and maybe cost me a lot more anyway. So, you know, we got professionals and got it all taken care of. And right in the middle of all this, I find out from the plumbing company that had I attempted to just go ahead and change the water heater out myself, I could have just gone down to, you know, the local Home Depot or whatever, bought a water heater, lowered it down in there, grabbed a dolly, yanked the old one out, hooked it all up. I could have done all that stuff. But had I done that, unbeknownst to me, I would have been violating the city ordinance and the county ordinance because, oddly enough, it requires a permit and an inspection. So I would have had the city zoning inspector come into my basement and approve my work because I'm not a licensed plumber, because I'm not a recognized plumber. Because of that, the county would not have given me a permit without the city zoning inspector. That same guy, the same motorhome in the driveway guy, that guy would have had to have come out and inspect my basement. Lovely. But as it worked out, you know, I called the plumber, and they work it out with the county, and they have all the forms. And so when they show up to change the water heater, they can issue the permit right there on the spot, and we don't need to have the inspector come into my basement and poke his nose around. And And so that we got to deal with that at the same time that we were dealing with this other thing with the city, with their silliness. But once again, so what's a person to do when you find yourself in a job and you realize that that job is wrong? It's evil. It's immoral. What you do for a living is bad. What do you do about it? Do you live with yourself? Do you just keep doing the job? Do you just bow your head and close your eyes to the evil and just keep doing it? Do you try to expose it? Do you make yourself obnoxious to your fellow employees until eventually you get fired from the job? Now, all these are different. There are actually legitimate strategies, any of these are. Gather as much information as possible and try to expose whatever the corruption is that you're looking at? Or do you try to expose waste in the job? Or do you go the other direction? Do you decide, you know what, I'm going to try to set an example for my fellow employees, and I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to show them what a good person is like with a good work ethic, and really do my job well? Or do you try to get a transfer out and to stay within the system but just get transferred out? Or maybe you try to get transferred into a position where you can, I'll put this in air quotes, you can fix the problem from inside. You know, these are the thoughts that come through your head. And there's not one answer to this. There are situations like with the Manning and the Snowden situation. These are two very different circumstances. Manning being active duty in the military, Snowden being a contractor. Very, very different circumstances involved here. But either way, the wise thing to do is to sit down and plan what you're going to do in a step-by-step way and really think out the consequences of what's going to take place and be prepared to take actions according to those consequences and be prepared to accept those consequences. But mostly is to be realistic with yourself and to have a plan before you do it. With Manning, there's no reason for him to have suffered like that. It doesn't, whatever good may have come from him suffering, more good would have come from if he had not suffered, if he had gotten away free and been, not captured and not tortured for however long it was. And the same thing with Snowden now, he would be a lot better off if he were living in Chile under an assumed name, then, trying to run across Russia, hoping that he's going to stay alive and outrun every CIA bullet that comes after him. Now, I wasn't sure if I was going to have time to talk about this today. So this is now for something completely different. We'll have our Monty Python moment there. There's a book out. I haven't read it yet, but I'm looking at the review of it, and it's very fascinating. I'm going to read the review of this book. It says, it's talking about the main topic of the book, and it says, both of these findings are amplified in the new book, Conspiracy Theory in America, by political scientist Lawrence DeHaven Smith, published earlier this year under the University of Texas Press. Professor DeHaven Smith explains why people don't like being called conspiracy theorists. The term, and this is the really important part here, the term was invented and put into wide circulation by the CIA to smear and defame people who were questioning the JFK assassination. The CIA's campaign to popularize the term conspiracy theory and make conspiracy belief a target of ridicule and hostility must be credited, unfortunately, with being one of the most successful propaganda initiatives of all time. In other words, the term conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist as an insult are doing so as a result of a documented, undisputed, historically real conspiracy by the CIA to discredit people who were investigating the JFK assassination. So the term, again, the term conspiracy theory is based on a conspiracy that the CIA did to discredit people who believed in a conspiracy. Isn't that weird? And to read on in the review in this book, it says, the smoking gun in the cover-up of the assassination is found in CIA dispatch number 1035-960. This was the crucial covert directive to the CIA's Operation Mockingbird elite media assets. Directive to CIA's Operation Mockingbird elite media assets to vigorously denounce critics of the Warren Commission report as conspiracy theorists. This is when that particular derogatory term of denunciation and disinformation entered the national conversation in an attempt to cut off and stifle informed debate on the president's murder, because the path of evidence would lead directly to those elements behind this sinister cover-up. These facts are discussed in detail in Lance DeHaven Smith's authoritative book, Conspiracy Theory in America, Austin, Texas, University of Texas Press. So I would like to get my hands on that book. Eventually I probably will, and give it a read. But I really like the introduction to the review of that. Because it just has that weird twist that the very phrase conspiracy theory was the product of a conspiracy to discredit people who were looking for a conspiracy. That's really funny. Now, since I'm talking about conspiracy theories, and since I'm talking about, Manning and Snowden and all these things, and since I'm talking about the CIA, just doing something to Snowden in the middle of Russia and, just blaming it on a pickpocket or whatever, if you think that's far-fetched, I teased this the other day when I had Chandler on the podcast. This reporter, Michael Hastings, he's the guy that got that top level general who was basically the top general in Afghanistan, got him fired for things that he had said. And Hastings, and you can look all this stuff up for yourself. I'll put some links in today's show notes. But Hastings had done a thing in Rolling Stone magazine exposing this general and exposing his staff, and it ended up bringing down the general and getting him fired and so forth. Well, then Hastings had been very outspoken for some time, and one thing after the other had been revealing the hypocrisy of the regime, and he had been showing a lot of the lies that the government has kicked out about Afghanistan, about Iraq. And he was really outspoken about these things. Well, then he was right on the verge of revealing something really big. He had, he had tweeted, he had sent emails to people close to him. He had made all these indications that he was going to have to go underground, that he was being watched, that the FBI was following him, that, perhaps friends and relatives were not necessarily safe. He had actually contacted a WikiLeaks attorney, and was, and this was the night before his death, and actually talking to the WikiLeaks attorney about what he needed to do. Now, the problem with that is, and this is to a certain extent, this is like what I was talking about with Snowden and Manning. At least Michael Hastings had his eyes open and was seeing how serious this is, and was starting to make arrangements so that he could be safe once he revealed this information. And, of course, if you're not familiar with the story, the night before he was supposed to reveal this information that was going to blow the lid off the CIA and expose them for the horrible organization that they were, his car suddenly accelerated, went out of control, went super fast down the street in L.A., crashes into a tree, explodes into a big fireball, and burns him to death. Well, and then immediately, and this is how the media does, immediately the local news shows a shot of from the scene of the accident, a close-up of a beer bottle laying in the gutter, which has nothing to do with Michael Hastings because he didn't drink and hadn't drank in like 5 years. But they show a close-up of the beer bottle in the gutter, and they say, toxicology reports are not in yet, so we don't know if this is alcohol-related. Well, that puts it right into your mind that it's alcohol-related. So people say, oh, well, he was drunk. That's the end of it. Nobody needs to question it any further. See, the media has already shown us this, right? Well, no. His friends and his family say that, first off, he was in really good spirits. He had a lot to live for. He was not drinking. He hadn't touched alcohol in years. He was a really slow, careful driver, even to the point of being annoying. So so there's no reason that any of his friends or family could think of that he would be going like 100 miles an hour down a street in L.A. at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was. And there's all kinds of other things, too. Like, there's the accusation. Well, the engine, when he hit the tree, the engine flew out of the car. And some people are saying that this is because of an explosion, that the car didn't just catch on fire like a car catches on fire, that it literally exploded and blew the engine out of it. And, of course, immediately Mercedes-Benz, the maker of the car, says, A, our cars do not explode when they go in, in crashes. And B, our engines and transmissions do not detach from the vehicle and go flying when they're in a wreck. These things don't happen. And yet this is what happened in this case. So we're waiting. We're still, it's like a month and a half, or maybe longer. Maybe I think it's like a month and a half since he died. And they still have not released the toxicology report. But what they did do was, against the will of the family, They cremated the body before they sent it back to the family, even though the family had requested that, the body, because they, maybe, who knows, maybe they were going to have a private autopsy or a secondary or whatever. Who knows what they were going to do? It didn't matter. L.A. County did their autopsy and then cremated the body and sent them the ashes. And so it's done. It's over. You can't double check their work. And, of course, they're still dragging their feet on the toxicology report. But it doesn't really matter anyway because, we heard, this was years ago, that the FBI got caught and admitted that they were faking the results of lab work. This is the FBI. Well, if we can't believe the lab work from the FBI, why should we believe the lab work from the LAPD? Keeping in mind, this is the same LAPD that's had so much problems, or LA County, I should say, has had so much problems with their coroner's office. And now here's another thing that's about this Michael Hastings thing that's a little bit interesting. So the car that he was driving in was a brand new Mercedes-Benz, and in that car, everything is controlled by the computer. The windows roll up and down by way of the computer. The switch doesn't directly connect to the window. The switch connects to the computer. The computer rolls the window up and down. The same thing with the seat belts. The computer tightens the seat belt right before a wreck. The computer steers the car and will parallel park it. It controls the steering to parallel park the car. So the computer has control of the steering. The computer controls the braking system. When you push on the pedal, all you're doing is telling the computer to brake. The computer does the braking. The pedal doesn't do the braking. The same thing with the accelerator. In the olden days, you would push on the pedal, and the pedal moved either a cable or a shaft, and that would accelerate the engine. Not now. Now you push on the pedal, and the pedal tells the computer, and the computer tells the engine to do whatever it is that you want it to do. Well, that's the way it is with these new cars. And we're being shown now that lots of hackers have shown that you can very easily hack one of these new cars, including the Mercedes, and completely take control of it remotely. As a matter of fact, the car, in something maybe in a totally different direction, we also heard just the other day that, and I talked about this with Chandler a bit on the podcast with him, the famous, world-famous hacker Barnaby Jack, 35 years old, just mysteriously drops dead. And we're told, oh, it's not suspicious, there won't be an investigation, and we'll probably have a toxicology report in a month or two or whatever. But it's not suspicious, don't worry about it, nothing here to see. And yet, Barnaby Jack, earlier this year, was working on how it is that hackers are able to hack the computers on cars. That was one of the projects that he was working on this year. Now, that's not the main one. He was working on a different project that he was going to reveal at the big hacker convention, where you can remotely get control of someone's pacemaker and literally kill them from about 50 feet away just by putting a surge through their pacemaker. You can do that with your laptop. and he was going to reveal that at the big hacker convention. But now some people are also wondering if he was going to talk about remote control of cars at that same opportunity when he had the stage. But we don't know, because Barnaby Jack is dead at the age of 35. So what's going to happen to Snowden? I don't know. I would not have revealed myself the way Snowden did. I would have figured out a different way to do it. If you're in one of those jobs, if you're in a position where you know what you're doing is unethical and you've got to do something about it, think it through. Get advice. Be very careful who you get that advice from, because your friends will turn on you, especially if they're within the industry. But think it through. Find out what you need to do to safely come up with the best, the wisest decision, and then do it. Don't just reveal stuff. Don't just quit. Don't just, you know, open the floodgates. Don't put yourself out like that. Martyrdom is not the answer. We don't need that. We can win this battle without martyrs. Folks, thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.